You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
That looks like Mary and Jeff. I wonder if they'll say hello to me. Maybe they'll cross the street so they won't have to.
Welcome to episode 203 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenau, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Will Slater from Exploding Helicopter to discuss a 1976 film that is the second chapter in a trilogy of Eurocrime thrillers, starring Maurizio Merli, John Saxon, and Barry Sullivan, directed by Umberto Lenzi. It's Violent Naples. But first...
Michael Shore, 45, husband, father, is an astrophysicist. Several days each week, he commutes to a distant laboratory where he's engaged in...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Happy to announce that we've installed Burns-O-Matic in-car heaters for your comfort and pleasure. When you receive your heater, you'll find it very easy to place in your car. Just roll down your front window and rest the heater's bracket on the window with the cylinder on the outside of the car. Roll up your window securely as far as it will go to hold the heater firmly in position. For maximum results, tilt the face of the heater towards the windshield and sit back and enjoy the show in healthful comfort. With these modern, safe, efficient in-car heaters, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round. If you have any further questions about your Burns-O-Matic in-car heater, please contact one of our theater attendants. And remember, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round, regardless of the weather.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle. Packed in a jar for the freshest flavor. Served cold in a sack for you to savor. So dainty to eat, no muss, no fuss. An ideal snack for all of us. Crisp, tender, and tasty with a bit of spice. Buy one now. taste how nice. Snack bar clerks will knock themselves silly, speeding your order for a real chili dilly.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Journey now to an age undreamed of. An age of mystery and magic. Of swords and sorcery. The warrior and the sorceress on a planet lit by twin suns. Evil warlords battle to control the fate of an entire dynasty. A mighty warrior rises out of legend to free an enslaved sorceress.
There was a time when I could command,
and I would obey.
Together, they forge the mystical sword whose blade cannot be broken. The ultimate struggle between good and evil. Sorcery. Dungeons.
I don't work cheap.
David Carradine in The Warrior and the Sorceress. The mightiest of all heroes. In the greatest of all adventures, The Warrior and the Sorceress. Their sacred bond cannot be broken.
And now, on with the show.
Morning, sir.
Ah, come in, Betty. Sit down.
Thank you.
I'm very happy to see you. And I'm delighted that you've agreed to have a go with us.
Thank you, sir.
Sorry about this early morning visit.
Actually, I was held up a bit. Happens I was needed in the office. An attempted robbery. A woman was molested.
I hope you've got something to build a case on.
There's no way. And to complicate everything, her husband's unwilling to collaborate with the police at all. He's scared. His reputation's what he's thinking about. But we assured him it wouldn't hit the papers.
That's typical. But you mustn't stop the manhunt.
Naturally, I won't. I promise, sir, I'm going to get those boys.
I know just how you operate in order to bag your suspects. I admit your system works. Though I don't admire police brutality, I suppose the results are what excuse your using it.
They do. If it upsets you, perhaps you should be signing passports. I frankly feel you might like it better.
Meaning what exactly?
That cops like me are fine for combating violence with violence and brutality. But the minute they get in the way, they become scapegoats for politicians.
You can't imagine the difficulties this attitude presents to us, Inspector.
I understand perfectly. I'm going to tender you my resignation. Keep it in your desk drawer. And whenever you'd like to dismiss me, there's a way of doing it.
Okay, our movie this time is Violent Naples from 1976. And joining me to discuss this film is Will Slater from Exploding Helicopter. Will, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here, Todd. Always enjoy coming on your show and talking about a forgotten film.
I always enjoy having you. You are one of my go-to guys. You know, there are folks that I'm
blushing.
Who haven't I had for a while? Oh, we got to get Will back on the show, you know. But for those folks that are unenlightened, who have not been here all of those other momentous occasions when you've been on the show, please remind everybody about who you are and what you do.
Well, yes, I run Exploding Helicopter, Monster, which is a project that I've been running for 14 years now. And my aim, I know, what a sentence that is. my aim is to catalogue every known film that has an exploding helicopter in it. So, yes, the strange phenomena, the strange ways that helicopters keep exploding in movies. I've been doing it for 14 years. We're now up to 771 films with an exploding helicopter. My work, if anything, the pace of discovery of new exploding helicopter films seems to be increasing. I've got some very, very great supporters on Twitter who keep tipping me off to undiscovered exploding helicopters in films. So, yeah, I've been doing it for 14 years. I think I'm going to be doing it for at least for another 14 years, Todd.
We'll make sure of that for sure. Yeah, well, you mentioned your Twitter. I mean, Twitter and Facebook, I actively follow you on those because I am anxious to see those updates all the time. I mean, just this morning, I was getting up, logging onto things, and boom, there's Will Sight saying, we found another one in G.I. Joe the movie from back in the 80s. So I was like, oh, I remember watching that on TV when I was a youngster.
Yeah, I am, as I say, one of my keen supporters of fans on Twitter. One of them is a real animation junkie, and they have just been, in sort of the last few months, just sending me a steady stream of, exploding helicopters in animated movies. And obviously G.I. Joe, the movie, obviously that's an American one, but Japanese animation through the 80s and 90s is incredibly fertile ground for exploding helicopters. Obviously, I think, very adult sort of orientated animation there, and seems to, for whatever reason, they seem to like to include exploding helicopters in those movies. So,
yeah, I don't think we had as much in the realm of animation in my childhood in the U.S. for sure, because, that was back in the days when, you couldn't get away with that stuff. I was actually a little surprised at the G.I. Joe one, because I was like, they had guns and tanks and things like that, but, they also had to kind of keep it on the down low a little bit there, because it was, afternoon television, and it was selling toys, and so you couldn't upset the parents too much there, that's back in the era where we had like a Saturday morning cartoon show that was based on Rambo. You can't get that violent
exactly
with that.
The same thing, Todd. I was just going to say, well, the 80s was a strange era where you had a Rambo cartoon aimed at kids. I mean, that was it is mind-blowing to think that actually happened.
So you said you've had a lot of things lately from animation, but just how has it been in general? We're getting towards the end of the year here. Has 2023 been a good year for exploding helicopters?
Yes, there has been quite a few movies out this year with exploding helicopters. And I went and saw one of the new ones that is out this year, just this very day. So I saw Tiger 3, a big Bollywood movie starring one of their biggest stars, Salman Khan. As the title suggests, it is the third in the series, and it's the second film in that franchise to feature an exploding helicopter. And the film's been out for a little while, so I'm not going to do a spoiler here. There's a guest appearance from another big Bollywood star in that film, and that star had a film out earlier this year, another action movie, and that has an exploding helicopter in as well. So yeah, Indian cinema, I've been having to see quite a few films this year because they've been very busy with the exploding helicopters. Yeah, but it's been a decent year for exploding helicopters in movies.
I haven't delved into Indian cinema too terribly much. So interestingly enough, the movie theater that's actually nearest to me is the one where they play the Bollywood films here in our area. They, you know, the movie chains will like pick one of their theaters and that's the one where they'll do the Bollywood films. And this is the one nearest me is where they do that here. And I've seen that title. You mentioned Tiger 3. I was like, oh, okay. I assume this must be the third installment of something. I'm not familiar with it. I have noticed though that on your lists, and I guess maybe this is on my mind because our last episode we had Matt from Direct to Video Connoisseur talking about, you know, direct to video stuff. And I find it interesting how on your Letterboxd list of Chopper Fireballs that we see a lot of direct to video films. And I'm like, boy, these folks don't have a lot of budget money, but they sure make room for exploding helicopters.
Yes, they do. And those exploding helicopters are not necessarily ones that they have blown up themselves. So those sorts of movies make quite copious use of stock footage that they have borrowed from other movies. And actually, in the upcoming episode I have got of the Exploding Helicopter podcast, I'm going to be reviewing the 1990 Gene Hackman movie Narrow Margin. And that quite a famous that film features a very famous exploding helicopter because it has been reused multiple times in at least five films. I mean, Narrow Margin was a reasonable, I mean, it made money at the box office, but I wonder if it's made more money in the fact that they've been hiring out the footage from that film ever since to other filmmakers. So it's probably turned a very handsome profit by now.
Oh, is Gene Hackman moving up the list then of actors in exploding helicopter films? Because I know one of the times I was on your show, we talked about a Gene Hackman movie that had an exploding helicopter. I think, what was it? The Domino Principle was the title?
That's right, yes.
And I remember we were like, boy, it seems like the actual actors are really close to that helicopter when it explodes. Like, it looks like it was pretty dangerous. Like, Hackman probably, after they yelled cut, said, "What are you doing?"
Yes, he's known for his robust, critiquing of directors and letting them know what he thinks. But he's actually been he was in obviously the Domino Principle and Narrow Margin, as you mentioned. He was also in a kind of forerunner of Rambo, actually, given that we've already been talking about that topic. Uncommon Valor. Don't know if you've seen that one,
right,
where Hackman goes back to Vietnam to rescue some POWs. That has an exploding helicopter in as well. So Hackman, forerunner of Rambo in some strange way. I think he wears, you know what? I think Hackman wears a bandana in that film.
I think you might be right. Yeah.
Wow. The kind of the origins. Sylvester Stallone needs to send a Christmas card, at the very least, to Mr. Hackman, I think.
Absolutely. Well, let's get on with our movie here today. Now, I guess one thing I was going to ask before we move on to the film, this is a Italian police crime film. It's a big genre for the Italians. Is it a big genre for exploding helicopters? There's none in this movie, but is it generally one?
It is not one that often throws up exploding helicopters. There, I'm racking my brains furiously trying to think of one. There's kind of a sort of it's made in Canada and it stars Stuart Whitman, Shadows in an Empty Room. I think it's also called Blazing Magnums as well. It's got one of those various titles and it's kind of influenced by this sort of genre, and I think there's some Italians are involved in the production of it, so I wouldn't say that it is a full-blooded Polizio Tesci, as I think this genre is called.
You did better with the pronunciation than I am going to do, I'm sure.
I'm going to go with Eurocrime for the rest of this podcast. So much easier to say. And there is another one which Silent Trigger? Anyway, the long and the short of it is it's not terribly fertile for exploding helicopters, but it has plenty of other good stuff in. Lots of car chases, gunfights, and punch-ups, so there's plenty to entertain you even if helicopters aren't exploding.
Absolutely, and we will get to that here in a moment. So yes, let's get to this film. It's called Violent Naples, released in 1976. Napoli Violetta. That's my attempt at Italian there. Terrible. I'm not Italian.
Very good. Very good, Todd.
Directed by Umberto Lenzi, a very prolific Italian director who had a steady stream of films going from the 50s all the way up through the 90s. And basically a guy who hit pretty much all the genres that Italian cinema is known for. You know, he did giallos, he did peplums, he did these poliziotteschi, whatever we call them, Eurocrime. But perhaps the most notorious part of his resume is that he is basically considered to be the father of the Italian cannibal films, having directed what is considered to be the first one, Man from the Deep River, and then going on to things like Eaten Alive and Cannibal Ferox. So this is a name we mainly associate with the cannibal stuff. But anyway, this film is actually a sequel. It's a sequel to a 1975 film called Violent Rome. So now we're at Violent Naples. And it did have a third installment as well called Special Cop in Action, also released in 1976. I guess they went away from the whole violent fill-in-the-blank formula there. But anyway, so this begins with the arrival in Naples of Commissioner Betti, played by Maurizio Merli. And he has been transferred to Naples and is being welcomed by the local cops. But right away, Naples lives up to the title of this movie and proves itself to be a crime-ridden city. In fact, Betty doesn't even make it to the police headquarters before he is thwarting criminals and hauling them in to prison. Now, the story here of this film, it's a bit episodic, as this no-nonsense cop deals with various low-level crooks committing various crimes. There is one section of the film that deals with an ex-con who must check in with the cops every day, yet he manages to stage these elaborate bank robberies on the complete opposite side of town at the same time. And then he like hops on a motorcycle and they zoom him off, and he then goes to the police station and checks in so that he's got this airtight alibi. It seems, though, that much of the crime that's going on in the city is being orchestrated by a big crime boss known as the Commandante, played by Barry Sullivan. His goons are terrorizing and intimidating the local business folks, both big and small. This includes a businessman named Francesco Capuano, played by John Saxon, who may not be as innocent in all this as he seems. Of course, Berti goes to all sorts of extremes to take down the Commandante's network of criminals, pushing the limits of what is allowed by the law. Now, this film, I think, is clearly very much influenced by Dirty Harry. I'm sure we'll get into that as we go on here. But I'm going to let Will get us started. Give us a few of your thoughts on Violent Naples.
Yes, well, Violent Naples is... I enjoyed it. I think it's a very good example of the Eurocrime genre. So we've got a take-no-prisoners hero, or maybe he's more of an anti-hero. You know, we have Naples here. It's a completely lawless city that's teeming with criminality. And yeah, Commissioner Betti is fighting his one man war to try and clean up this city. And I think within this film, we get this, the kind of the milieu of this film, is one of real cynicism here. So, you know, corruption is just endemic. Criminality is rife, and that forces at least Commissioner Betti to take on some very extreme measures in order to try and restore law and order to the streets. So, I mean, this is a film it's filled with plenty of action. It's not a particularly deep movie, but it does have some themes, and I think it does does some good work to highlight those. Overall, I thought this was a good film. It's got a bit of a cult reputation, this one, and whilst I enjoyed it, I for me, it's not one of my favourite sort of Eurocrime films that I've seen. I certainly don't lay claim to being an authority on the subject. I'm still very much sort of working my way through them and, you know, learning about them as I go. So, yeah, interesting. It was interesting to see that this film does have some very ardent supporters out there. Didn't quite see, you know, I wasn't quite as enthusiastic as they were about this film. But overall, I enjoyed it. And yeah, I can see why it is one that, you know, does have some fans out there.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it too. I think that, you know, maybe the folks that are strong supporters of this film, it may be because of a few that really just big kind of shock moments that the film has, you know, that you just kind of sit there and go, oh my gosh, I don't believe they just did that. I have, and I guess that kind of points to the difference between the American approach and the Italian approach to this kind of film. I mean, that's one of the challenges, I think, with any film like this. And, you know, I've watched a few of these Eurocrime movies, and I always struggle a little bit just with kind of getting used to the way that they do things in Italy versus the way we're used to with an American film. I mean, there's always something that just feels a bit off. And I experienced that with other films from other countries as well, just because it's not what I'm used to. I chalk that up to being, well, I'm not in the know. I'm not used to this culture. You know, I mean, like, I can sit down and watch a Jackie Chan film and enjoy it immensely, but there's still things that I go, huh? What was that? You know, because it's just not the part of the world that I live in. And I think that can certainly be true of this film. I think also just kind of the Italian approach to filmmaking is jarring. I mean, especially with the way they do the dialogue and, you know, the way that it's filmed, where, you know, you have the Italian cast, you know, is delivering all their lines in Italian. You get your token Americans in there like John Saxon, and they're delivering their lines in English, but everybody redubs all their lines. And so then depending on what, you know, where you're watching the movie, you're kind of seeing different things coming out of their mouths. And you know, that can throw you a little bit. You kind of wonder if I'm losing something in the translation and such. But I think despite those challenges, this film has enough going on, some good action, some good moments that do grab you, even if I think the film does kind of meander a bit. I mean, it, even though we've got this Comandante character that's the crime boss and over everything, it kind of, the film kind of plays out in chunks where we're dealing with Betty, dealing with these different low-level crooks and the things that they're doing, and he takes care of one and moves on to another and so on. And eventually we get kind of the takedown of the big baddies at the end of the film. So, I mean, in some ways the film almost plays like it was a series or something like that, like a television series that where they've stitched together a few episodes and then we get the climax at the end of the season where we take down the big bad.
Yeah, it's, I mean, episodic is a good way to describe it, which is, you know, word you used. I mean, it's very loosely plotted. I completely agree. And, you know, we have this sort of friction between Capuano, John Saxon's character, and the Comandante. And obviously, but Betty is, it's almost like Commissioner Betty is in another film. And it's only really right at the end do those strands start coming together. For the rest of the time, you know, Betty's, Commissioner Betty's, you know, Merle's main focus is on tackling Casagrande, the bank robber that you mentioned, who's, you know, motorcycling across Naples at high speed to set up his alibi. And yeah, the film, it does, I mean, that is definitely something that is, for me, stopped me enjoying the film quite as much. You know, you can kind of enjoy those vignettes in and of themselves, but they sort of, yeah, they don't sort of necessarily stack together terribly neatly. And I do think ultimately it harms the film.
Yeah, I would agree with that. All that being said, I like some of these little short segments. I mean, I think the one with the bank robber is the best one. I mean, just, I love the idea of it, that this guy has been in prison. When Betty comes in, he knows this guy already. He's kind of notorious. All the people in town know him. They're like, oh yeah, that's that guy. He's the worst criminal in town and he gets away with it. Nobody ever stops him. What's going on here? You know, we're sick of it. And he sets up this elaborate thing where you got the bank robbery going on, which I thought, you know, for a bank robbery scene plays out pretty well. I was like, okay, this is cool. And then he hops on the motorcycle and is zooming across the town. And I tell you, that motorcycle, I don't want to call it a chase because he's not being chased by anybody, but he's zooming around the town at these crazy speeds. And he's riding on the back. He's not even driving. Somebody else is driving him. And the way they filmed this thing, you know, there's a lot of it that's from the point of view of the driver of the motorcycle. There's some of it where it's like somebody's hanging a camera down by the wheels of the motorcycle. You know, we're seeing the motorcycle zoom around. And there's very much this, like, almost like a guerrilla filmmaking quality to it, where you get the impression that, like, they just set up on a corner and told the guys, okay, drive the motorcycle by here as fast as you can, and then we're out of here, you know?
Yeah, I don't think they had any permits for what they were filming. Those, as you say, not car chase sequence, more car race sequences, I think. As you say, the filmmaking, or not the, the camera work in those sequences is brilliant. I mean, they use a lot of low angles, the point of view stuff where they, you know, it's shot from the perspective of the, you know, the motorcyclist. It just creates a real, you know, exciting dynamic sequence. I the footage is sped up a little bit, and that's more obvious at some points rather than not, but still, somebody was on the back of a motorbike going pretty fast and just sliding in between, like, lorries and parked cars. I mean, without a lot of clearance room there. So, I mean, it doesn't even with even without speeding up the footage, somebody was putting themselves at a, you know, fair risk of harm to get these shots in the can for old Umberto Lenzi.
Yeah, there's some spots that are sped up because, you know, if you look closely, you'll see, like, oh, well, that guy's walking very fast over there on the street. Other moments where I'm going, that doesn't look like it's sped up, you know. So I think they kind of might have gone back and forth. But yeah, it's very effective, whatever they're doing there. I mean, it reminded me the way they capture it, kind of the varying angles, the speed, just, you know, it looks dangerous, you know. So it kind of had that kind of Ozploitation vibe to it. And I was like, okay, this is cool. I'm totally on board with this.
Oh yeah. These sequences really sort of pop out of the screen at you. Like, you can't, you know, even if your attention has been wandering, you're like, there's no way it's going to be wandering during those sections of the film. Cause yeah, some very exciting sequences that they put together for that.
I love also the way that when this bank robber guy, this ex-con, then shows up at the police station, just how smug he is about the whole thing. Like, you know, I really pulled one over on these guys, you know. And when Betty started to get suspicious of him, he's like, well, how could I have possibly did it? I mean, I'm right here now, and that's all the way on the other side of town. There's no way I could cover that distance. You know, I mean, like, he's giving too much information because he's so proud of himself, you know.
Yeah, he's got that sort of cockiness that you really want from a criminal that you know, or you certainly hope is going to get his comeuppance at some point in the film. So yeah, he plays that part you know, very nicely. But I mean, I really liked you mentioned these motorcycle sequences. They're very good, but there's some other really good action sequences in this film as well. So I mean, I really enjoyed the rooftop chase sequence that we get.
Oh yeah.
I don't know. I mean, who knows who was the first person to do anything in a film was, but you know, it felt quite fresh here. I was racking my brains thinking, have I seen somebody do something like that in an earlier film? I mean, they're still doing it now, but 1976, was anyone do it? Anyone doing it earlier than that? But it was a really good sequence. And I'm sure we're going to sort of talk about it. The stuff on the tram as well, talking about people putting themselves in danger. You know, Maurizio Merli seemed to be doing quite a bit of his own stunt work here. And I don't know how much he was getting paid for this movie. I'm not sure I would have been terribly keen about doing some of the stuff he was doing on top of that tram.
Oh, no, I definitely want to talk about that sequence. But going back to the roof, I agree. The roof sequence is a lot of fun. Also has this, you know, kind of fly by the seat of your pants feel to it, where you're going, yeah, they didn't get permission from the owners of any of these buildings. They're just hopping around out there. Again, I like the camera angle such, you know, a lot of Dutch angles and just kind of things things that kind of throw your perspective off that I thought was a lot of fun. Also, just I thought it was fun the way that the rooftops are completely covered with TV antennas. There's like a million TV antennas up there. And I'm like, that looks like it would be just a challenge to, you know, not have to zigzag around the antennas, you know?
Yeah, they were lucky to sort of come away with all their clothes on. I mean, they could have, you know, could have left most of them behind stuck on an antenna.
Yeah. Well, the train, though. Yeah, let's talk about this train scene going up the mountain, which actually has some other elements when we talk a bit more about kind of the level of violence in this movie. Mm. But yeah, having our lead actor hop on the top of this train, which is it's an incline railway. OK, so it's basically going up a hillside and the bad guy has gone in there. He jumps onto the roof of this thing. And yeah, there's these shots where it's just no denying that it is actually the lead actor. It's not a stuntman. And yeah, there's like all these like low hanging wires and things, which you have to think there's got to be some electricity or something going through these wires. I'm thinking this looks really dangerous.
And it's moving as well. I mean, if he puts his head up at the wrong time, it's coming off. I mean, you know, there's no second chances for Maurizio Merli here if he makes a misjudgment. So yeah, I was impressed by his commitment. And you know, we can because of this sort of choice of shots here, we can see there's no you know, and also because of the age of the film, you know, we can see he really was on the roof of that thing. There's no safety. There's nothing to catch him if he slips off or anything. And
right.
Yeah, it's 1976. They weren't CGIing any sort of safety harnesses out here. So yeah, he's really clinging on to that thing for, you know, probably for dear life.
Who wouldn't? Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk more about our lead character here. Like we said earlier, Betty is clearly a take on Dirty Harry, though I would say, you know, it's got a lot different approach than Clint Eastwood does here. But I guess, you know, as Dirty Harry ripoffs go here, how's he doing?
Well, I think he's doing great stuff here. I mean, he's a kind of classic tough cop, plays by his own rules, and kind of what I enjoy sort of beyond, I guess it's, you know, the Italians' own spin on the Dirty Harry genre. So, you know, they have that type of character, but they then put them into a, you know, this, as we were, you know, talking about, this sort of seething cesspool of criminality. But the kind of, you know, the bosses at the police station are very, very cynical about Betty. I mean, they disapprove of his methods, but they are happy to go along with him whilst he's getting results. But if his methods start causing them too many problems, then they're just going to get rid of Betty and they're just going to blame it all on him. And it's just, and, you know, he's just stuck between, I guess, a rock and a hard place between the criminals who largely treat the police with complete disdain. And, you know, Betty. And then the other side of that equation is the police bosses who, yeah, would quite happily, if you know, Commissioner Betty never came into work again tomorrow, they'd be, you know what, that's better. It's a quieter life.
It's funny that the police bosses are actually pretty low-key through this whole thing. I mean, you're used to kind of the standard, these police captains that are just a bundle of nerves and oh, Riggs and Murtaugh, you're doing it to me again here, you know, that whole thing. But these guys are just very, oh, well, yeah, you know, and they're just very low-key and not too stressed about things. And I thought, well, that's an interesting take on these guys. But I loved that Betty comes in there from the beginning and it's just like, yeah, you're not going to like my methods. That's the way it goes. I've already written my letter of resignation and you can keep that in your desk. And whenever you feel like you need to use it, you got it there. And I was like, what a great gimmick.
Yeah, that is a really good gimmick. And yeah, as I say, it feeds into this sort of world of you know, this very cynical world that this film, you know, portrays. Because yeah, his boss sort of says, yeah, you know, well, you know, I'll take your I don't like your methods, but I'll take your results. But yeah, if your methods, you know, if I start having, you know, somebody starts, you know, complaining to me about your methods too much, then yeah, I'm just gonna jettison you without too much, you know, without any Vera a favor, and yeah, that's when Betty offers him. She said, okay, here, you can have my resignation letter now. And as you say, yeah, it's a great gimmick, which plays into the ending of the film, which is which I very much enjoyed.
Well, and I like that as soon as he's introduced, I mean, we get it clear as day that, you know, this is a cop who has absolute contempt for the criminals, no patience for them at all. I mean, the first exposure he has to the criminal element when he gets into Naples, you know, these guys trying to steal a car, and
he's barely got off the train into Naples, and there's already been an assassination attempt on him by the commandante. I mean, this is all within like 2 minutes of the film starting.
Yeah. But the car robbery thing, he goes and he slams the car hood down on one of the guys. He's just pounding it down on him and such. And like later on, he's like, when he's chasing down people, you know, he catches them, and it's not just, all right, you, let's throw the cuffs on. He catches them, and then he beats them up. And then he takes them up, you know? It's like, all right, yeah. I mean, but at the same time, he's got a lot more kind of just emotionless approach. I mean, with Dirty Harry, I mean, you know, Dirty Harry, you see him seething and all that. Mm-hmm. You don't get this here. He's very much just kind of collected through the whole thing. It's just like, all right, I'm going to pummel you, but I'm still cool, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he's got, you know, he also looks very cool as well. I mean, he's got an absolutely magnificent head of hair and, you know, a truly fine moustache as well. And,
there's a lot of epic moustaches in this movie.
there certainly are. I mean, he's, you know, very suave looking character, and the actor here, Maurizio Merli, from what I understand, he was a very big figure in the Eurocrime genre. He made quite a lot of films in this particular genre. I think he also worked with Umberto Lenzi again on some further Eurocrime films in the back end of the 70s. So he was a big figure in this particular genre. And I'd be very interested to check out some of his other films. I think he made three films as Commissioner Betty, and from what I understand, he also had a sort of another recurring sort of police character, I think like Inspector Tanti, from what I was reading, I think that's the name of the character that he plays in another sort of film series. So yeah, somebody I'm be very interested in seeing some more of his stuff in this genre.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I needed to bring up about him here, though, that going back to like the Dirty Harry comparisons, it's been a long time since I watched the Dirty Harry series. I don't remember him having this fondness for mop-topped, precocious little kids.
It really could have added something to those films, though, couldn't it, Todd?
I suppose it could. But yeah, I mean, it's a weird little streak that this film has where we've got this kid character there. I kind of liked it, though. I actually liked the kid. I mean, you know, when I first saw him coming, I was like, oh no, this kid's gonna just derail this whole thing. But he's got this kind of thing where, yes, he's kind of weird and precocious and that, but I never found him to be all that annoying. I mean, maybe it's because when he's first introduced to the film, he's like limping across the road, and then, you know, it's like, ha ha, I was faking, you know, which of course that's going to play into things later too. But yeah, I don't know. If you got to put a kid in the movie, I was like, all right, I'm okay with this kid.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, you know, they were flirting with danger with this character big time. But I have to say, I ate him up in this film. I really enjoyed it. I think also the fact that the film is dubbed, I think just also sort of in some ways aided it, because it just kind of hard to put my finger on it. Just sort of, I mean, it's a fairly broad performance, and then it's even broader because it's dubbed. And yeah, I really enjoyed this character. I mean, he really looks the part. As you say, he's got mop top, and then I really don't know what's going on with his teeth. I don't know whether they've been knocked out or they're still growing through. I mean, it's they say the British tend to have bad teeth, but This Italian infant had had terrible teeth, but I was so fascinated by him, Todd, that I ended up I sort of looked him up. So the actor who plays him is called Massimo Dedda, and he only sort of made a handful of films, all I guess when he was a kid. But weirdly, he keeps playing the character Generino. I don't think there's a through line in the character, but his character is always called Generino. So he was in another Naples set crime film called Weapons of Death, playing Generino. And then, interestingly, for me anyway, but he plays Generino again in another crime film called La Pagelle, where he plays sort of another young boy who is the son of a car mechanic. And I mean, in that film, he gets murdered and his dad then goes out, you know, to get revenge on the murder of his son. But yeah, uncanny parallels with Violent Naples there. And yeah, I was like, where is he now? But sadly, couldn't find any information. But yeah, if anyone knows what happened to Massimo Dedda, I'd love to know.
It's the Generino cinematic universe right there. It's all connected. That we just spoiled the final chapter of Generino's life there, because he dies in one of these films. So
I want to see more of his work, that's for sure.
Well, let's shift to the villains here. Let's talk about how we think they do kind of being baddies. I mean, like we said, there's a bunch of them. In fact, I would say maybe one of the faults of the film is that there's maybe too many villains. They get a little bit hard to keep track of at times. They're all pretty nasty, though. These guys do some nasty stuff. So yeah, what's your take on the baddies?
Yeah, we get some good ones here. So Casagrande, we've already sort of mentioned him before. I very much enjoyed him. He's very cocky, he's very suave, he's got that sort of haughty arrogance of, you know, you're not going to catch me. And I think he plays that part very well. I mean, he's largely amused by the police. He's certainly not afraid of them. We then have Barry Sullivan as the Commandante. And you know, Barry Sullivan, he's one of those actors that I really, really sort of enjoy. And, you know, he's kind of like, he's just one of those actors, I don't know, that sort of unsung heroes of Hollywood. I mean, he's just a rock solid actor. He sort of didn't do many lead roles, but he's kind of often the sort of second lead supporting actor. And, you know, whenever I see him in a film, always impressed by him. He's just one of those, like, you know, really versatile actors. You want him to be a tough gangster? Yeah, he could be a tough gangster. You want him to be a henpecked husband? Yeah, he can do that. Comedy, drama, no problem. I wouldn't say this is necessarily his finest work. I mean, he does get a few nice moments, but he doesn't have an awful sort of lot to do apart from sort of, you know, wander around in a suit and, you know, dish out some orders.
It's not a terribly colorful character, but I think he does a good job of kind of being just this guy that clearly, you know, is over everything, is powerful enough that he doesn't really have to do much other than, you know, wave his hand and tell these other folks to go do his dirty work, you know.
Very much so, very much so. And then, yeah, we've got John Saxon's character, Capuano, and I don't know what you found, Todd. I found that his character was a bit confused. I was confused by his character. I didn't quite know what he was up to. I didn't quite know what his game was. I mean, clearly he was sort of out to do some sort of double cross on Barry Sullivan, but quite what it was, I don't know. I was unclear.
It was one of those cases where, like, I sit down to watch this movie, the credits are rolling, you're seeing the names go by and go, John Saxon. Okay, I'm buckling in here, you know, because I mean, Saxon is great in a lot of things. And I think from what I saw, this was really the first time where he was the token American in one of these Italian productions. He would do this many more times. But here it's like, okay, I'm glad to see him here. He's bringing that kind of cool that I expect from John Saxon. But at the same time, it's like, there's not enough of him in this movie. He kind of comes and goes. Like you said, I'm unclear on what his goals are, what his dynamic is with the Commandante. And, you know, like, it was the type of thing where, like, he'd show up again. I was like, oh, yeah, Saxon. Okay, what's he doing now? You know, so, yeah, I think he was misused in this film.
Yeah, I completely agree. And sort of going back to something we were talking about earlier, like we've got these three villains, but they don't really, their plot lines don't ever really mesh together. Certainly not in any way, not in any great way. And yeah, you just feel like they could have been, you just felt they could have all been better employed. Like, you've got Barry Sullivan, we both like him. John Saxon, you know, screen legend, you know, he's capable of doing some good stuff. I have to say, not familiar with the actor who's playing Casagrande, but he's doing a great job. You know, you kind of, so you've got individually, they're great. They're not, collectively, they are not used well. And yeah, and that is to the detriment of the film that we watched.
I actually had a few points in this film, and you know, I don't want to take anything away from what Maurizio Merli is doing, but there were a few moments where I thought, I'd like to see this film with Saxon in that role.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I'm always fascinated with these sort of Italian sort of genre films from the 70s as to the American actors that they pick. I sometimes wonder, it's like, you know, I can't remember the title of the film, but I saw, you know, I was browsing something, and like Arthur Kennedy was one, and I was like, Arthur Kennedy, I mean, he, again, an absolute, you know, Hollywood pro, but by this point in the 1970s, would he really be opening up much box office in the United States? I mean, you had people like Lee J. Cobb turning up in these films, and, you know, Henry Silver, and yeah, I'm always very, very, I mean, nothing against them as actors, but I'm always like, did they really have that much box office cachet to kind of help with the financing or the box office of these films? Always very intrigued with the selection of American actors that these Italian producers were choosing for some of these films.
It's one of those things that you see show up in genre films of a number of other countries, you know. I mean, like, that's one of the great charms too of like sitting down and watching a Japanese kaiju movie and you see like Russ Tamblyn show up or something like that, you know. So yeah, loads of fun. Well, okay, we skirted around this a bit. Let's talk about just the violence in the film. There are a few shocking moments that come up here, which I kind of expect going into an Italian movie. You know, I've watched enough giallos and things like that to know that at some point they're going to splutter some bright red paint around, you know, and you know, really try to make you jump out of your seat with a shocking death of some sort. So I guess, where do you want to start? What are the moments that jump out for you here? There's a couple.
Yeah, well, I think for me there were three. I think the first one that we get is fair, reasonably early in the film, and yeah, Maurizio Merli is chasing a criminal, and he tries to climb over a fence and ends up slipping and skewering himself on the top of the fence
through the throat.
Yeah, yes. Through the throat, up through the head. At that point, I was like, that did sort of like, ooh. Did we? Okay, we're going there now, and we're doing it now.
And it's completely because of the klutziness of the criminal.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's not like Bernie pushed him or anything like that. He just slipped.
He did indeed. And yeah, he's definitely, I'm pretty certain he was dead at the end of that sequence. So yeah, then it's sort of relatively, we don't get, I mean, we get lots of sort of car chases and punch-ups, but Umberto Lenzi definitely turns the dial up to 11 in the home stretch of this movie, because yeah, going back to that tram sequence. The poor lady who gets her head gets a free facial from Casagrande, who just mashes her head into the side of another train that is passing in the opposite direction. He just shoves her head out the window and just mashes it against this other train, and it's, we get to see it hit,
yeah, it thumps each and every several times inside. Yeah. And it's the icing on the cake of that scene too, is that he does this, pulls her back in, she's all bloodied and such, and then 2 seconds later, Bernie bursts through the ceiling and shoots the guy. And you're like, you couldn't have done that 3 seconds earlier? Come on, man.
Well, it would have, you know, would have deprived us all of this gore that, Lindsay would be employing later in, his cannibal movies. So he'd really, you can see his him developing his techniques for some of the later films. But I was a bit, I was a bit disappointed with Barry Sullivan or what he gets to do in this film. But he does get a great moment in the violent stakes where ties up a police a police informant, or I think he's an undercover cop, isn't he, that ties him up at the end of a bowling alley, and then the Comandante then goes for a strike straight into this poor guy's head, and he comes a cropper. So a good nice sort of bit of twisted violence to just kind of give us a little idea as to how Barry Sullivan made it to the top of the criminal tree in Naples.
Early in the film, I was like, the Comandante doesn't strike me as the type of guy that hangs out in bowling alleys. all right, whatever. It makes for a good weird scene here. And I mean, that was just, it was wild for me watching that scene because, I mean, I grew up in the Chicago area, bowling. We are given a bowling ball at an early age. I was in youth bowling leagues growing up. So it's like, you kind of imagine sometimes, hurling a ball at somebody that was picking on you or something like that. Also made me think my dad, it reminded me that my father, when he was in like high school, he worked as a pin setter in a bowling alley. This was before they had automatic pin setters, and such. And he always told me, that's the reason why they have lane courtesy, why you don't bowl at the same time as the person next to you. It's not because, it's distracting. It's because the pin setter needs a place to be standing when the other person's bowling. So
how times change.
Well, we should start taking this through to the break. We need to hit on the ending here a bit. You kind of, mentioned you wanted to hit on a few things here. So let's talk about where things go once Betty cleans up the town, at least a little bit here. Take it away. What do you want to talk about here?
Well, I guess I wanted to talk about, we come full circle with Generino. I think that's what I really enjoyed about this ending. So Maurizio Merli, the commissioner, I mean, he basically shoots dead Barry Sullivan and one of his goons there, cold-blooded assassination by Commissioner Betty. So I mean going full Dirty Harry and then some, kind of frames John Saxon for these murders. He's so sort of disgusted, isn't he, but with his bosses that he finally says, you know what, it's time to get my resignation letter out of the drawer. But then he's quit the police and he's driving off to whatever the next chapter in his life is going to be. And then we see little Generino limping across the road. Unfortunately, this time
for real,
because he's been crippled permanently by the villains in this film when they murdered his father. And that so moves Commissioner Betty that he's, you know what? I have to stay in the police because only I am equipped to go after these criminals. And I really enjoyed that little come full circle moment when we come back to Generino, Chekhov's child or something.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a fun moment. And then the the credits roll with this fairly bubbly song over it, which was a little wild too. But I don't think I would have come up with that ending, but I was like, okay, I could deal with this. This is fun. Yeah, I mean, overall, this is a film that I will say it's a little bit of a challenge, I think, just because of some of those things I was talking about before in terms of kind of the lost in translation type of aspect, just the differences in the culture, the approach to filmmaking, all that. it does, like we said, kind of meander. It's episodic, but the payoff moments are good. And I think there's enough to get on board with here. I mean, it's just a straightforward, tough cop type of story. I mean, there's like no women in this at all, other than victims. There are women who are victims, but there is no love interest for the cop or anything like that. This is not a chick flick. There's not, the producers did not say, well, we got to put something in here for the ladies or whatever. Nope. They're just like, all right, it's just a cop who's killing bad guys, you know?
Yeah, I mean, of the Eurocrime films I've seen, I think it's pretty fair to say that they don't pass the Bechdel test. And that they're most the women in these sorts of films, that they're mostly prostitutes or rape victims. I mean, it's not many roles for them, and if they do get a role, it generally doesn't end well for them.
Yeah. Well, any final thoughts you have on this before we go to the break?
I mean, I'd say I enjoyed this film. I'm continuing my investigations into the Eurocrime genre. If I was, you know, I wouldn't suggest that this is one to start with. I would say maybe start with something like Almost Human or Live Like a Man, Die Like a Cop, or is it Die Like a Cop, Live Like a Man? Look it up, you'll find it. Maybe start with one of those. I mean, I do think, like, if you really like, if you're going to get into this genre, I think it does pay to do a little reading up on kind of the influences and what was going on politically and socially in Italy at this time, because those factors do influence like the plots of these films and the kind of like the extreme approach to violence and the cynical world that we see in many of these films. So yeah, if you are interested in the Eurocrime genre, maybe start in a couple of other places, do a little homework, however boring that might be. I think that will definitely add though to your appreciation of the films.
Cynical is definitely a good word to describe things. I mean, they're not doing the tourism board of Naples any favors with this movie. So, all right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to hear from another one of our podcasting friends, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
At Cinema Recall, we want to present to you the finest in film analysis.
Yeah, like action and gore and sex.
We will look at classics by Kubrick, Lynch, Godard, De Palma, and Coppola.
I don't know who that is, but I'm looking at classic bodies of Christina Hendricks, Keanu Reeves, Salma Hayek, Ryan Reynolds.
We are a serious show for film lovers who enjoy indie foreign films, art house gems, and classic black and white features.
Well, I enjoy big-budget blockbusters with great action and sexy people. Maybe our podcast can celebrate all aspects of films, like people who feel like your weird way and, like, people who feel like my weird way can, like, get together, man.
They can?
Yeah.
Huh. You know, I like that.
Cinema Recall is available everywhere you find great podcasts. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram under Cinema Recall Podcast. And on Twitter at @cinema_recall.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can help support this show through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features, including a whole bunch of the older episodes of this show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. So visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more. We thank you for your support.
Hi, I'm Jason Soto.
And I'm Lisa Leahy.
And we're the host of Between the Scares, a podcast that takes a look at every movie that Blumhouse Productions has made. You may not recognize the name, but they have made some of your favorite horror movies like Paranormal Activity, Ouija, and Insidious.
Yeah, Jason, but they've also made stupid movies like The Fever and Best Night Ever and Hysterical Blindness.
Yeah, those two. But they also did Whiplash, Get Out, and Us, and we're going to cover it all.
Hey, did you know that Jason Blum also produced that Gem and the Holograms live-action movie?
He did that?
Uh-huh.
Ugh. fine. But then you have to watch The Green Inferno.
So
listen to Between the Scares on Anchor, Apple, Google, Amazon, or our home location at rabbitholepodcast.com.
Jim Rex? What's Jim Rex? Would you believe a movie audience guide presented as a public service by this theater's management to help you select your motion picture entertainment? Well, that's what it is. And we urge you to learn these rating symbols and use them as a guide for you and your family. G means suggested for general audiences, all ages. M, suggested for mature audiences, parental discretion advised. R, restricted, persons under 16 not admitted unless accompanied by parent or adult guardian. X, persons under 16 will not be admitted. This seal in advertising indicates that the film was approved under the Motion Picture Code of Self-Regulation.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie, something we want to let everybody else know about. It might be a forgotten film. It might be an old classic. Might be something new in the theaters or on streaming. It could be anything. So, Will, what is your recommendation?
Well, I always like there to be a connection between the film we reviewed and my recommendation. So in Violent Naples, we get to see Barry Sullivan as the crime kingpin of Naples. And so that reminded me of another film where you can see Barry Sullivan be a crime boss. And that is 1947's The Gangster. In that film, he plays crime boss who's reached the top through his ruthless use of violence. But sort of in doing that, he's basically alienated sort of everyone in his life. And he then, though, kind of falls in love with a woman, becomes sort of infatuated with her. And that means he sort of takes his eye off the ball of his criminal dealings. And there's some young shark looking to overthrow him. And therein lies his doom. I mean, this was a Poverty Row crime film. But, you know, it really is elevated, really kind of like surpasses its sort of limited budget and means through several factors. You know, first and foremost of which is Barry Sullivan, a great performance from him. I mean, he's sort of in that classic tradition of sort of schizophrenic crime characters. He's, you know, one minute he's totally insecure, then he switches on a dime and he's like, you know, he's ruthlessly kind of, you know, inflicting some violence on somebody. We've got a great supporting cast. Got Elisha Cook Jr., the great gravelly voice Charles McGraw is in this. There is some wonderfully stylized dialogue in this film. And I mean, I've only seen this film once and it was over 20 years ago, but it is always stuck in my memory. And the opening of this film, if you are not like all in on this movie in the first 2 minutes, then like you can check out and, you know, you're not missing anything. But yeah, there is a great sort of piece of narration from Barry Sullivan as he sort of describes the world in which this film's taking place, and he sort of describes, you know, who he is as a character. And yeah, it's a fabulous piece of narration that just like grabs you immediately from the outset, and you're like, okay, this is going to be good. And The Gangster, I've only seen it once years and years ago. It's always stuck in my head. If you're into film noir, if you're into 40s crime films and you haven't seen this, go and check it out.
This looks like a cool flick. I mean, you mentioned several people in the cast there. I was like, yeah, this looks like, I also saw like Harry Morgan's in here. An uncredited Shelley Winters shows up, I guess.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that this is like a Poverty Row crime film and all that stuff. And I mean, there's something to be said, you know, I love the gangster films, the crime films, you know, from the likes of Warner Brothers and things like that. But there's something to be said for these like ones that did not have quite the support behind them that those films had. There's sometimes it's just this wonderful gritty charm to those films. So yeah, this looks like a good one to check out. So for my recommendation, I also tried to tie it in somewhat, but yeah, I don't have a Euro crime movie to talk about here. I was trying to look at other films from, you know, Italian filmmakers and such. So I am going to go over to another genre of the many genres that Italy is known for. I'm going to go with a horror film and one of their foremost horror directors, Mario Bava. I'm going to recommend 1963's Black Sabbath, which is a horror anthology film with three stories in it. And I'll just say at the beginning here, I often struggle with anthology movies just because I think it's kind of like the nature of the beast, that you're going to have certain segments that are going to excel and others you're going to go, that wasn't so hot. It's just, they tend to be uneven. And I think especially when we're dealing with horror anthologies, this is a rare horror anthology where I thought all three segments worked very well. Depending on what country you're in, though, the order of the segments varies. I think the version that I watched is the one that would have been released here in the States by American International Pictures. But the three segments, there's one called The Telephone, where it deals with a call girl who's being terrorized by threatening phone calls. The second segment, which I think was last in the version that I watched, is called The Werdulak, which is kind of a vampire-ish sort of story featuring Boris Karloff. And then there's The Drop of Water, where there's a nurse that steals a ring off of a corpse and then is terrorized by the dead woman and such. Like I said, I think they reorganized them on the AIP version. AIP, I think, also reshot kind of the segments that connect the three chapters with Boris Karloff doing some introductions and such. But Mario Bava, you know, skilled horror director, and he does a great job here. This film, you know, takes a lot from kind of the different horror styles. You know, there's a little bit of the universal gothic style horror. There's a bit of Hammer in here. Of course, there's a bit of Italian giallo in this. And it all comes together very, very well. It's creepy. It looks great. And it's just a real solid bit of horror. And I got to give it up for Boris Karloff. I mean, we're 30 some years after Frankenstein and the Mummy and stuff here, and the old man proves he still got it. So, you know, I thought he was really great in this.
Yeah, Karloff aged like a fine wine, didn't he? I mean, he was still doing some, I mean, he was doing some terrible schlock, but he was also still doing some great work, you know, into the 1960s.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Will, as always, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and all your projects out there.
Thanks, Todd. Well, yeah, if you are interested in finding out more about the strange way helicopters explode in films, then you can come and check out my website, explodinghelicopter.com. You can listen to our podcast, which is called Exploding Helicopter. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on social media. We're on Twitter as @ChopperFireball. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram, on Letterboxd. Yeah, you search Exploding Helicopter, you'll find us.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, folks, that's going to do it for this installment of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you, as always, for listening. Of course, you'll find more reviews of Forgotten Films over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can follow me on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And, of course, you can like us on Facebook as well. We welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And while you're in the typing mood, if you could leave a positive comment over on iTunes or wherever you listen to this show, we'd greatly appreciate it. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn more about how you can help support this show. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again real soon.
You know, I think I'd like to try for a strike.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.